ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The community 3 hours south of Perth is breathing a sigh of relief tonight after pods of pilot whales were shepherded away from the coast in what could have been a massive whale stranding. Unfortunately, there were some casualties. We'll take you there in 1 minute. G'day, Jono Kendall here, broadcasting from Sail in Victoria on Gunai Kurnai country this Anzac Day. And it's been a big day of dawn services, marches and commemorations focusing on duty and sacrifice. But what happens when defence members get home? How hard is it to make a life after the military? You'll find out from someone who went from serving in the infantry to an office job. And spoiler alert, it wasn't an easy transition. That's coming up in 5 minutes. 30 pilot whales have died after beaching themselves at Dunsborough, 3 hours south of Perth. And when news of the stranding became public this morning, the beach was swamped with volunteers wanting to help. And they did, keeping the whales wet and helping to usher other pods of whales away from the beach. ABC reporter Jackie Lynch says there's a lot of relief about those whales leaving, but there's still a chance they could come back and beach themselves nearby. I spoke with her a short time ago and asked her how it's played out.
Well, it has been quite a day. There was about 160 whales stranded on the beach here in Dunsborough this morning. But in good news, a large portion, the majority of those whales have been moved off shore. So there was about 160 whales. About 130 of those have gone out to sea. Sadly, about 30 of the whales didn't make it, which is very sad news. But remarkable. You don't always see whales in this situation make it. So it's just a matter of keeping a close eye on those whales that are out to sea and removing the ones that sadly did die.
Yeah, a huge community effort though. It sounds like there were lots of people on the beach trying to help.
There absolutely was. Right from when people got the word that there were whales down here, they jumped into action and they came down to help. So it's a beautiful community down here in the southwest, and everyone really rallies together in situations like these. So a lot of volunteers came down and they were helping keep the whales wet and then heralding them back to sea. We actually spoke to one local who had been there from very early this morning.
It must be really, really sad for those people who've come along to do their best to try and save these whales, and yet, as you say, 30 of them have died. This is Ian Weiss, who's been on the beach for most of the day.
Many of them are dead. It's quite distressing.
So I imagine, although, you know, lots of people would have turned up to try and save these whales, but were unable to save 30 of them.
That's right. And it is really distressing. It's not a nice atmosphere to see these whales both dead and dying. And a lot of people kind of came too late, and the whales were sadly dead by the time they got here, the 30 that are still on the beach. But it's not a nice thing to see, but it is such good news that so many of them did survive today.
Yeah. Why do whales beach themselves like this?
We don't know. We don't know. It's a phenomenon that we see relatively often here in the southwest. And these are pilot whales, and it's usually the pilot whales that we see stranded on the beaches here, and every opportunity that they strand is an opportunity to learn more about these whales, and particularly now that whales have gone out to sea, we can learn about, you know, what was the effort, what was the thing that got them out to sea. Maybe we can learn a little bit more there. But it's just something that happens, and unfortunately it happens in big groups. We had early this morning a pods of whales that were still out to shore but stranded themselves along with the ones on the beach. So one whale goes into shore and the rest tend to follow. And it is very hard in these situations to get the whales back out to the beach because they do tend to keep coming in. So the fact that they went out several hours ago and they stayed out is really, really good news.
And it does seem to happen, particularly around that part of Western Australia. Down near Albany last year at Shane's Beach, there was a big stranding down there. And then back in 1996, there was quite a significant stranding as well. Is there any idea about why it is happening in that part of the world?
Well, we don't know. It's something that happens, and we have had quite a few. We have seen, like you said, the one in Albany that happened just last year, and there was more than 100, I think it was about 150 whales that were caught up in that one, and most of those sadly died. We also saw one just down the road here in Augusta. It's just something that happens, and there's, lots of whales that usually all come together, but not totally unheard of.
Have most people gone home from Toby's Inlet now, or are people hanging around to make sure that those whales don't come back?
It's pretty quiet now. Most people have gone home. There was hundreds of people here earlier when I first got here, but now it's pretty quiet, and it's only really the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions and their staff, and they're tagging the whales and getting ready to remove them from the beach. There's talk of some big trucks coming in to take them away, so hopefully this is the end of the journey.
ABC reporter Jackie Lynch, who's based in Bunbury but has spent the day at Dunsborough after a whale stranding in which 30 whales died.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Today, you've probably heard a lot about the hardships and sacrifice of military service. But what about when servicemen and women return home? Veterans have a higher risk of depression, anxiety, substance abuse, cancer, arthritis, heart disease, and stroke. And new research shows returning servicemen and women face big challenges in accessing the services they need to stay healthy, particularly in regional areas. Dr. Kylie Carra, a senior lecturer in occupational therapy at La Trobe University in Bendigo, has just released a research paper on this. And Frank Chambers is a Vietnam veteran from Bendigo in central Victoria. G'day to you both. And to you first, Frank, what was it like adjusting from life in the military to civilian life?
I found it very difficult. I served in the army in infantry, so we were outside all the time. I returned to my job, which was an admin officer in an office, and I could climb out the window, I think, at times.
What did that feel like? Like, tell us about what was going through your mind when you were trying to adjust to civilian life.
Yeah, I found it hard at times. Most of the time was okay, but I did find it difficult because it wasn't, well, I was one of the few in that era, that particularly in that job, I think I was the only one in the office, so found it difficult.
Mm. And did you access any occupational therapy services at that stage?
No, there was. I guess they were available, but I'm going back to late 1969, early 70, and if they were there, I was never aware of it, no.
Yeah, right. Well, that's part of what you found in your paper, isn't it, Kylie, that there's kind of a lack of understanding about occupational therapy, particularly from GPs, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like sometimes our profession is stereotyped as, you know, providing equipment or completing home modifications, which is one very small part. But really what's important to us is to make sure that people have meaningful occupation. So like Frank was describing, finding meaningful employment or connecting back to sport, voluntary work, and finding that sense of purpose again after finishing military service. So yeah, there's a lack of understanding, I think, in the community about what we do, and also about some of the types of therapies that we can offer, such as cognitive behavioural therapy, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and vocational rehabilitation.
Yeah, and Frank, was there any of that sort of stuff recommended for you when you were transitioning back to civilian life in the 70s?
No, nothing at all. As I say, we were national servicemen, and when we got back, we got a temporary, because we'd been overseas for 13 months, got a temporary discharge, had a medical, out the door, and that's never heard anything more about it.
So what worked for you? How did you transition to civilian life?
One day at a time. When we were overseas, we used to count. It was, when we got there, was 365 in a wakey sort of thing, and then as you got a month to go, it was 30 in a wakey, so you're anxious to get home, of course, and yeah, just one day at a time, John. There was, I did have a mate who'd served, also served over there, so we'd get together and have a few beers, of course, and that was probably the way we readjusted, I guess.
Yeah, and we know that returned servicemen and women are at a higher risk of lots of health problems and mental health problems. Australian former service members are twice as likely than the average or than the general Australian population to report having a disability that impacts on occupational participation. I'm reading here from your study, Dr. Kylie. But what can we do about that? What can we do to turn that around, do you think?
I think a lot of it comes down to advocacy and obtaining more funding support for services. So we've got some really incredible recommendations from the Joint Transition Task Force and the Royal Commission into Defence and Veteran Suicide. But at the end of the day, if there's not the adequate funding there for clinicians to be getting professional development and being able to deliver the complexity of services that is needed, then it's going to be difficult to do that. I think my other thoughts around that is that we need more research or better understanding for specific population groups. So I know you mentioned female former service members, and I think the other group on my mind, particularly at the moment, is people from a culturally or linguistically diverse background. So yeah, absolutely more research to understand the service needs and what makes services more accessible for kind of subpopulations of former service members.
Mm, and we know that returned servicemen and women are at a higher risk of suicide. There's stats that bear that out. And Dr. Kylie, what's your experience with mental health for ex-servicemen and women?
So often former service members come back from service with musculoskeletal injuries, but really my experience is that it's the mental health conditions and underlying exposure to traumatic events during service that really often presents a barrier to people being able to connect back with their families, back with workplaces, and back with their communities, and it has a big impact on their quality of life.
And Frank, it's Anzac Day. What is front of mind for you when it comes to what former servicemen and women need to, you know, to transition to everyday Australian life?
Yeah, well, I voluntary work at the Veterans Support Centre, I'm only as a pension officer, so I've had a fair bit to do with veterans, the younger ones as we call them. But Anzac Day sort of it does bring it to a head sort of thing, and it's also you think about your mates.
I imagine that would bring up a lot of sadness. Like, I mean, you think about your mates, and I'm guessing the mates that you lost?
Yes, a couple of them, and I suppose it's also more prevalent for me that I had an uncle killed at Gallipoli. He was killed on 26th of April, 1915, of course.
Mm. And Dr. Kylie, I know you've done a lot of thinking about occupational therapy and what could be done to improve the lives of people who return from war zones. What are the key things that you want to get across to decision makers?
Yeah, I feel like occupational therapy has a much bigger role to play than we currently are, and that it really can help to address what's at the heart of people's difficulty in terms of transitioning back to everyday life, that that connection to, you know, meaningful activities and connection to community is something that we can, yeah, play a really important role in.
Dr. Kylie Carra, a senior lecturer in occupational therapy at La Trobe University, and Frank Chambers, a Vietnam veteran from Bendigo in central Victoria. And if you are going through a rough patch or you just need a chat with someone friendly, call Lifeline on 13 11 14.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Don't forget, you can access a podcast of this show through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia Wide website. Just search for ABC Australia Wide. And you can always email us. We'd love to hear what's happening in your part of the world. australiawide.radio@abc.net.au. The Boer War of 1899 to 1902 has always been remembered in history as the White Man's War. It was fought between British would-be colonialists and the Boer South Africans of Dutch ancestry. But fragments of letters sent from the front challenge that narrative, James Tugwell reports.
History might have forgotten Private Frank Leighton Sinclair had he not sat down to write a letter from Bloemfontein in South Africa to his brother back home in New South Wales's Kangaroo Valley on March 17, 1900, during the Boer War.
Two men accidentally shot themselves, and one has since died. It's a terrible sight to see men and horses lying dead all around.
Mr. Sinclair wrote of walking through the night to avoid hypothermia after being stranded with no tent during the heavy rain.
It is grand to see our men stand under heavy fire. It is a curious sensation, but a glorious sight to see bullets and shells lodging all around us. It makes a man very determined to fight when he sees men and horses cut to pieces.
A few months later, and less than 200 kilometres south, another 28-year-old, Trooper Jack Alec Bond, wrote a letter home to Braidwood from South Africa.
I have seen quite enough fighting, and have had some very narrow squeaks. I reckon it has lasted quite long enough.
Neither could have known it at the time, but their letters would be published in newspapers and found decades later, revealing Indigenous involvement in what history has dubbed the White Man's War. Mr. Sinclair and Mr. Bond are now remembered as two of just 11 known Australian Indigenous men to have served during the Boer War. The two Ewan men from the New South Wales South Coast were on separate ships but departed from Woolloomooloo, Sydney, to the war on January 17, 1900. Mr. Bond sailed aboard the Surrey with the 1st Australian Horse. Mr. Sinclair sailed aboard the Southern Cross with B Squadron 1st New South Wales Mounted Rifles. Indigenous military historian Peter Backer has often wondered if the two men met while boarding in Sydney that day.
I've often had that thought. I'd like to think they did, but there is a possibility. Certainly is a possibility. Two men happened to leave at the same time from the same area, both Ewan and serving in the Boer War, and these two men are the only two I've found written correspondence from.
Mr. Backer has uncovered sections of five letters, one from Jack Alec Bond and four from Frank Leighton Sinclair, that were printed in local newspapers at the time. They are now the earliest known letters from Indigenous servicemen sent from the front during active military service.
Well, I knew straight away it was very important because we have very few letters actually written by Aboriginal men from this time period.
Indigenous men were permitted to enrol in the armed forces until the 1903 Defence Act and were considered on merit along with all other would-be soldiers based on their horse riding, marksmanship and bushman skills. It was only after two failed conscription referendums during World War I that then Prime Minister Billy Hughes relaxed the rules regarding the Indigenous enrolment so that anyone with at least one white parent could enlist. It was not until 1949 that all restrictions were lifted. Mr. Backer says the letters show Aboriginals have a long history of military service in Australia.
Anzac Day, Gallipoli, you got that bronze digger image. My research, Australia has been a multicultural society right from the settlement of Australia. And so, you know, I've got examples of West Indian, Maori, Chinese, Turkish, German. The whole gamut can be found within the Australian Army. They fight as one, as Australians. And I think we need to be far more aware that we've been very Anglo-centric in our thinking about Australian history and about Australian military history.
Illawarra man Daniel Dawson called his mother out of the blue in 2006 from outside a barber where his shoulder-length hair had just been buzz-cut. It was, he told his shocked mother, because he'd been accepted into the army.
I've just done it as a personal goal and don't know why or what was in it for me, but I don't know what come about or how it come about. I didn't have any family or friends that were in it at the present.
Ever since he'd seen a stall for the army at a high school careers day, the idea of serving in the military had appealed to Mr. Dawson. However, it was only after 14 years as a private in the Australian Army Reserve and a tour of Timor-Leste with the Australian Border Force that Mr. Dawson investigated his Indigenous past. He said he was astonished, wowed and baffled to learn his third great-granduncle was Frank Sinclair. Suddenly, his military service took on new meaning.
We're learning as we're evolving as people the epigenetics of things that, you know, when they say it's in your blood and, you know, that bloodlines can take a strong contribution towards what you do and how you do things in life, like that has reflected to me significantly. There's always been a strong connection towards the army.
Also in the family tree are 10 Sinclairs who fought during World War I and 22 family members who served during World War II. Mr. Dawson says it is important to remember the history of Indigenous people serving in the military and the letters from Private Sinclair because they show what Australia's forefathers endured.
It shows the hardship. It shows the sacrifice. You know, they've given me a sense of pride of dignity too.
Daniel Dawson, descendant of one of Australia's first Indigenous soldiers, ending that story by James Tugwell.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I didn't know Melbourne much. I knew where the racecourses were.
I'm making signs for the sleepy lizards.
Basically less eggs this year than what we would have expected.
The houses that are near the edge of the bush, they might encounter a snake up to 4 times a year, a death adder.
See how it goes.
On ABC Radio.
Now, if you went to a dawn service, Anzac Day march or ceremony today, you may well have heard the roar of aircraft overhead. The flypast has become synonymous with Anzac Day, and it's a good chance to see and hear historic aircraft up close. ABC Toowoomba reporter Peter Gunders caught up with Matt Handley, the lead pilot of a formation of 4 Australian warbirds that flew across Queensland's Darling Downs today.
Anzac Day is pretty special because we get a great deal of personal satisfaction out of being able to do it for the community. So that's the best part of it. The flypast events that we do start with an air display approval from the Civil Aviation Safety Authority. So there's a fair amount of paperwork and legality detail that goes into it as well, plus also getting the aircraft ready.
What's the most important thing that you're concentrating on while it's happening?
Basically just holding a steady speed and holding a steady attitude so the other guys can fly off my wing, and keeping it all safe, keeping everyone in the formation safe, having a good brief before we go so everybody knows what to do. Yeah, look at my watch a little bit to make sure we're on time.
It looks good from the ground when this happens. What does it look like from the air? What do you see and what are you looking at?
Just mainly my lineup points to make sure we get it pretty much in the centre and our altitude. Normally over a built-up area we have to fly at 1,000 feet, so that's why we have to get the CASA approvals for events like this, a special approval for 500 feet over the event.
Do you notice the people looking up at you? Can you see? I mean, everyone in town is looking.
Yeah, 500 feet, you can definitely see the event or the crowd when we fly over the Mother's Memorial, and it's good to see that crowd is getting bigger and bigger every year. So here's the first Windjill, Windjill 04. The Windjill is an interesting aeroplane, and there's 4 of them based here in Toowoomba, and us here at Aerotech, we maintain those 4 aircraft. They're an aircraft that was built by the Commonwealth Aircraft Corporation, designed and built in the 1950s to serve as a basic trainer for the Royal Australian Air Force. And they did that role very well all the way through to the 1970s. It was around 1975 when they started to get replaced with the CT-4 trainer, but the Windjills, with their time in service with the Royal Australian Air Force, they also trained Army pilots trained in them, Navy pilots trained in them at Point Cook, and they were a very popular aircraft. They're not an easy aeroplane to fly, but their radial engine, their tail wheel, they have a little bit more in common with the more World War II type aircraft than your modern type trainer. And they can be a little bit of a handful. The name Windjill itself is an Aboriginal name for young eagle. Yeah, it's a very uniquely Australian aircraft.
So when you're flying these on Anzac Day, which is such a special day for Australia, do you feel like you are, in a way, keeping history alive?
I'll have a look around the hangar. As you can see, most of the aeroplanes around you are like flying time capsules, flying time machines. I think it's very important to preserve the history of aviation, preserve the history of these particular types of aeroplanes, because they are unique, and they take a lot of care and attention and a lot of maintenance and a lot of time. Time is the biggest thing. Whether it's, I can do between 300 to 400 hours a year of flying. Flying the older aircraft is a highlight for me, and we enjoy operating them and looking after them.
There certainly were lots of aircraft in the skies over Australia today. That report from Peter Gunders, ABC reporter based in Toowoomba. And that's Australia-wide for this Thursday, Anzac Day. Remember, you can access a podcast of the show or listen back to the program through the ABC Listen app or by visiting the Australia-wide website. Just search for ABC Australia-wide.
ABC Listen.